As the COVID-19 pandemic continues to put a strain on economies throughout the United States, many nonprofits are feeling the impact, especially those focused on homelessness and poverty. With limited support from the public and rising demands for food and supplies, these organizations have had an uphill battle since the start of the pandemic. On this episode of The Purposeful Pitch, Phoenix Rescue Mission Chief Program Officer Nathan Smith joins my colleague Josh Skalnick and me for an in-depth conversation on the struggles and risks associated with homeless street outreach during a pandemic.
So how's everything in your world, personally, as it relates to what we're all dealing with? I know things are a little bit different in Arizona, than they are in New York, as it relates to quarantine and everything else. But how have you been?
You know, it everyone's seems like a lot of people's story is different. In my case, my wife is an emergency room nurse, and she works the COVID section. And she volunteers for it because it pays time and a half. And so that's how she worked. That's how she's wired. And so I've been more quarantined, than a lot of other people who work in essential services. So I've been working almost exclusively from home for the last month or so. But I'm about to come back out. I've had enough of the inside of the house, and I got three kids running around tearing everything up. So, homeschool dad and all that. I've also learned a lot about being more efficient with the way we live, and so it's been pretty good overall, actually, for us.
Yeah. So I'm head of the education practice here at Lambert, and hearing you talk about, homeschooling kids. How old are your kids, and how have you found that homeschool experience to this point?
My kids are 9, 7, and then I have a 1-year-old. So there was that first and third grade. And so one of the things is I realized that my kids have an unfair advantage over a lot of other families and kids who are in their situation. I mean, to me, maybe because of the kind of work I do, that stood out pretty hardcore. We have extra laptop. My mom bought them an iPad. I can afford $200 a year for them to get this membership that has all these graded modules and everything. So once we got our bearings straight, we set up a really nice curriculum. We have all the tools. They go to a really good school, so they sent a bunch of stuff home. Communication's been great. Honestly, man, it makes you wonder why we do it the way we do. And so it has actually been pretty seamless compared to a lot of others for my wife and I.
Hmm. So do they go to... traditional public schools, or were they in a charter school? Where were they before?
They go to a legacy charter school. Okay. Yeah. So it's pretty high rated, I guess, charter school. They do good stuff, and I have friends who go to public schools in areas that aren't as well resourced, and their experience is entirely different than mine. So, I mean, my school got everything up and going in like a week, right? It was crazy.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. Go ahead, Josh. Sorry.
Oh, yeah. Are they doing full time right now? Like, or is it just like an hour or two a day with the teacher? Because with my job, it's just an hour a day.
Yeah, they do. Each kid has an hour a day with their teacher. And so they kind of get 2 hours because they both sit in on the other kid's class. An hour a day, then a packet of homework. You just kind of follow it through. So there's some things missing, right, that teacher teaching you things. It's different from picking up a packet and, mom or dad having other things to do and working you through it. But all in all, it is a really good replacement for sure. And Khan Academy is also amazing.
Hmm. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how, as someone who's worked with schools for 25 years, it's a conversation that I had with people on how do schools evolve? Hopefully they do. Based on what they've learned through this. Certainly, I don't think we want all kids being stuck at home every day, but how can they take what they've learned through this and integrate it into, the best practices of what they were already doing?
Yeah. It reminds me of when I went to community college and I took a hybrid class, half online, half in person. And honestly, it was like the best setup. I go one day a week, do everything else online. I think they'll probably learn how to hybrid a little bit more, at least in the sense of leveraging technology better. That has to be an outcome of this.
Yeah, you would think that the issue there is the equity of and the availability of technology, you know, for all families. That is the one challenge. But, you know, tell us, you know, about Phoenix Rescue Mission and your role as chief program officer with the organization.
Yeah, absolutely. So Phoenix Rescue Mission as an agency has been around since 1952, working with people experiencing homelessness is who we've kind of always been. So for years, you know, we were soup kitchen and shelter, and we call it soup, souls, and salvation. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we were for the longest time. In the last handful of years, we've begun to evolve into an agency that really tries to empower the folks that are coming to us, people who are experiencing homelessness and addiction and such. And so we change our mission statement in light of that. We work with people facing hunger, homelessness, addiction, and trauma is our target population. And for us, what that looks like programmatically is we have a continuum that starts with people who are not currently in our campuses. So that's folks coming to the food bank. That's individuals living on the streets. We have a whole outreach team that's going out and visiting those folks and trying to bring them into different services. We have crisis stabilization that's residential, 7 days to get people out of their current situation into something better. We've got recovery program that lasts anywhere from 2 to 18 months. We run that for men and women with children. And so we really try to bring all of these things together into a continuum that has options for people who are really trying to get out of, again, that hunger, homelessness, addiction, and trauma experience. And so, I mean, in a nutshell, that's the mission. And my job as the CPO is a real blessing, is to basically oversee the delivery of all that, make sure that we have the right goals and that we run a top-notch program and that we vision cast for the future.
Yeah, I mean, that's just the breadth of programs you provide. It's extremely impressive, and the lives that it's impacting has to be rewarding and enriching to your life. But I'm just wondering, you know, so how did you connect with Phoenix Rescue Mission? You know, what were you doing before you joined the organization?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so back in 2014, by that point, I'd been working with a police officer and a caseworker who were working on this really innovative collaboration that was trying to get so-called justice-involved persons, right? Individuals experiencing homelessness who were also bound up in the criminal justice system through often like homeless-related crimes, trespassing, using the restroom outside, things like that. And they're repeatedly going into court. And so this caseworker and this police officer were working to set plea agreements and get them out of those situations. So through some church ministry that I was working with at the time and through the nonprofit I was working with at the time, bumped into them, started working with them to get some of the people that I was encountering out of these situations as well. And then down the road, again, in 2014, they advocated to our then CEO to get me a job. He took a chance and hired me. And so I came in to work here for the mission. But I mean, really going back to 2008, I've been involved in international missions to India, to working in impoverished school districts here locally and abroad, and working with people experiencing homelessness.
Yeah. Now, did you always have kind of a passion for this kind of work? I mean, did you see yourself as a teenager thinking along these lines of, you know, I'm going to work in impact, you know, for impact organizations? Or was this something that, you know, came through maturation?
It caught me out of nowhere, man. It really did. I went really reluctantly on a 1 month India trip when I was like 24 years old. I'm 36 now. So like 12 years ago, I was almost forced into it. Like my pastor and them were like, man, you just got to go. I was like, fine, I'll do it. Went out there. Life was changed in 2008 as far as from a vocation standpoint. And I realized at that point that I was going to be involved in working with the most down and out and impoverished communities and individuals, probably at some level for the rest of my life. And so before that, I mean, the Jordan documentary is out, just like every other kid. I was for sure going to the NBA. That didn't come close to panning out. And so, you know, I had a fitness career. I was a personal trainer and owned a personal training company for a while. And that was unfulfilling. It just made good money. And so then once I got what I was supposed to be about, like in my expression, what God was really calling me to, there's just never been any looking back. And it was that one India trip that changed it all.
Yeah, so you went kicking and screaming basically to on that mission trip. And you found your path as a result, which is often the way. Better that, you know, even though you had some reservations about going, you know, it's a blessing that you took a chance and it's changed your life. So that's great.
Yeah, that's been awesome.
Now, what are some of the biggest issues related to homelessness in the Phoenix metro area?
Man. It's a really good question. I'll just throw them into two categories, right? Two really general categories. There's micro factors and macro factors. Some of the biggest macro factors, they're really, you hear them a lot, right? There is a lack of affordable housing. There is a lack of living wage jobs, and the amount earned by the bottom tier of jobs has been outstripped by the rise of inflation, right? And so people don't have the kind of income that's necessary to afford whatever housing stock is available. And so those are, you know, income, housing, those are some of the big macro factors. Other ones like micro factors, which at the societal level are problems for us as a whole, but that really affect individuals, things like addiction. It seems sometimes in discourse that addiction is in danger of being sidelined as one of the issues that correlates with homelessness. Mm-hmm. Now, it correlates with a whole lot of other things like loneliness, death in the family, injury, et cetera. But it also is one of those factors that you see showing up in homelessness quite a bit. Then you have things like healthcare. And when people are unable, for instance, to afford it or need to continue to go back, and how that impacts them economically. Mental illness is a big problem. Crime is an associated problem. So really there's some big micro and macro factors that we're trying simultaneously to engage as it relates to homelessness.
Yeah, and I have to imagine that, and we'll get into this in a few minutes, you know, with COVID-19, obviously, it would be crazy for us not to talk about, but I have to imagine that has amplified, those macro and micro issues as well. But, you know, wondering, you know, so how do you tackle those issues? You know, how does the organization, and I have to assume it's in partnership with a number of other organization and state entities and whatnot, but so how do you focus on those and tackle them?
Yeah, honestly, nail on the head. Collaboration is a huge part of it, especially when we're talking about these big macro or micro factors. They're too big for any agency, governmental, nonprofit, for-profit, by themselves to handle, or even for a small collection of them. So we really do need collaboration across the system. You need various players from healthcare, from the criminal justice system, from mental and behavioral health to integrate with each other very deliberately so that we can work people through the system. We communicate with each other. People don't get dropped and lost from the system and things like that. So collaboration is a huge part of it. And then the mission, like I said, our part of it is to provide those services that we bring to the continuum as well as we possibly can. Homeless outreach, addiction recovery, and getting food to families.
You know, you mentioned a lot of collaboration, Nathan, and would you say the Phoenix Rescue Mission is, I know I've been working with you guys for about 7 or 8 years, and I noticed that you've seemed like you're on the forefront of collaboration with, private and public entities. Is that something that's on the rise? Like, and does it correlate to a reduction in homelessness or how have you seen these collaborations like work in real time? Because I know you're heading up a lot of those right now. So,
yeah, you know, it depends on which collaboration, the nature of the collaboration. So in one case, we have like collaborations with agencies that co-locate, so to speak, on our residential campuses. They borrow space from us and they provide the services that other people might go to them for right directly on our campus. That builds out the quality of even our internal continuum of care, our own programming. So for instance, we're never going to provide dental services to people. That's outside of our scope. We're never even going to think about it. We're not gonna provide, unless something crazy happens, we're not gonna directly provide medical services. We don't directly provide a lot of behavioral health services. I could go on and on and on, signing people up for food stamp benefits and things like this. We partner with other people to bring these critical services to the folks that are in our programs. And then that enables us to do a really good job of what our core programs are. We're not trying to be all things to all people. We're really trying to focus on a handful of things that we can do very well. And so the collaboration really builds out the quality of the service that we're able to provide, but it also expands our reach geographically. So partnering, for instance, as we do in the homeless outreach department with the city of Peoria, who provides us a good bit of funding to give services out there. City of Avondale is a funder of ours. City of Goodyear, City of Glendale has funded us very well to provide homeless services. Those partnerships allow us to extend the scope in terms of geographically of the services that we're offering. And so not only do we build out the quality, but we expand our reach, so to speak, through a lot of these collaborations.
Yeah. One of the programs actually that you guys are currently just recently launched, which is your Code Red summer heat relief campaign. It's the 8th annual one. And that's a prime example of collaboration. And tell us a little bit about the Code Red campaign and what are your goals for this year? I know there's a lot of factors that have changed, probably caused you to change your goals from years past, but go into that a little bit.
Yeah, well, I think the biggest factor that has maybe made us shift is just the fact that we've gotten so much water. So the community has been amazing. They have really come around the Code Red campaign in some amazing ways in terms of the overabundance of water donations that they've made to us. And so one of the ways that that's caused us to shift over the 8 years is who we really are giving the water to. So Code Red is really a three-pronged thing, right? We give water to groups of people who give water to individuals. So the county has a heat relief campaign. The heat relief campaign has hydration stations that people can go to get water. Because the community has been so good to us in donating water to us, we're able to provide water to those hydration stations that are set up in different places around the county. And we'll partner with cities to make sure that they have the water that they need. Another piece that we do is as we've always been well known for, we take this water, we get it real, real cold, and we take it right to people who are living on the streets, who are suffering out there in these extreme weather conditions. And so that's what our Hope Coach, those vehicles that are out on the streets every single day, they're ramping that up and taking that stuff out there. And then my favorite part of it is placements, right? So that bottle of water and the hygiene kit that we'll have, that'll have sunscreen, a white t-shirt, things that'll protect people from the heat a little better. Not only are we giving up that water bottle and that hygiene kit that we'll give out, opens up the door for further relationship, right? So it's a way to start to engage with people, to talk to them about how we can get them out of the situation. That's the third piece, is placements. So if we place them, then they're out of these extreme weather conditions and they're in an air conditioned unit. And so, I mean, I just think that just dealing with the abundance of gifts that we've gotten from the community has just caused us to think, how can we be really good stewards of this water resource?
Yeah, and just to follow up on that, Nathan, is so the evolution of that program. I mean, obviously it's grown and it's allowed you to touch more lives. I mean, what do you think is, you know, long term? What do you see in the future for that, you know, for that campaign? I mean, do you see bringing in more partners or, you know, shifting gears a little bit because of the success that you've had? I you know, just wondering what the future of that program looks like.
Yeah, so we have shifted already in dealing with the amount of water that we get. And that's why our partners program has really expanded. We call it community partners, actually. And that's where a nonprofit or a governmental agency or something like that can get food, water, hygiene, things like that from us. It's mostly water, and especially during Code Red. And so that's been a big part of it, is making sure that churches and whoever else has the water they need for the services that they provide. Looking forward more to the future, it's hard to say because I want to do a lot of things, right? Sure. So let me just say one of the things that I think would be really neat. One of the things that we used to do a little bit more of, and we still dabble with, is working with people who were once homeless or in a housing unstable situation and are housed now. right? And so now that our outreach team is housing more people, we're finding that there are some people who just don't get around well. And so a lot of those folks, and whether we're working with them now or there are other people out in the community we haven't worked with, those are the people who are really at risk for heat-related illness. If an elderly lady is in her apartment and she falls asleep, naturally, because that's what you do, and the heat goes out and she can't pay her bill and she's not got the wherewithal to call people and whatever, she's at risk of dying in her home. And unfortunately, that's what happens every summer here. And so being able to partner with people who know those folks and trying to bring some kind of relief into that space, I see as a progression for us in the future.
Yeah, that's
not to say that that's absolutely what we're going to do, but that is definitely something I think would be really awesome.
Yeah, I mean, it demonstrates the value of these types of programs and your organization in that there is that continuous evolution. And, you know, the more you learn, you know, how do you integrate those types of things into these types of initiatives, like your point about, you know, the elderly who, you know, who may be stuck in their air conditioning broke and, you know, they don't have the means or the contacts. They don't know where to go. And it sometimes, unfortunately, it results in dire circumstances. So that's fascinating. Thank you, Nathan.
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
yeah, it's just part of what it means to, I think, do the kind of work we do is you've got to be able to pivot. COVID-19 is, if nothing else, taught us that what you do now might not work for the situation tomorrow. And so constant evolution has to be a part of good programming. And that's what the mission's always been about.
And that actually rolls into what I was going to ask you is, and, you know, bringing up COVID now. So how have you guys adjusted your programming in Code Red specifically with, you know, it's being such a community focused initiative? How have you adjusted your protocols, if you will, to take in consideration of, you know, COVID-19? I mean, what is your guys' role in that too, as help as far as, you know, reducing infections, protecting the homeless, protecting those that maybe don't have access to care?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have a lot of stuff. Let me just say, first and foremost, one thing that did not happen is our services did not cease, right? They kept going. And so what we did is it looked different depending on the program. So at the food bank, we had to move intake and the whole operation outside. So we stopped letting people come indoors, but we still were making sure we provided food. And the thing that was crazy is that the number of new enrollments that we were seeing week over week just went up significantly compared to the norm, right? So we had to keep getting the food. We just had to move the operation outside to keep people safer. For the homeless outreach team, what we've done is we've got all sorts of masks, you know, the cloth masks, gloves, sanitizing materials, and we are actually now putting plexiglass up in the back. So if we need to transport persons under investigation of COVID, we're able to do that. And so we're just trying to be innovative about providing the services there. And we're applying for grants that reimburses for PPE and things like that as well. So that's been really helpful. For the residential programs, we had the only thing we really had to do there that hurt a bit was to stop taking in new intakes. So we didn't take in new intakes for a while to play it safe for the community that we already have on our men's and women's campuses. And some of those folks have now gone on to graduate and they're moving into, you know, different parts of program, which has been great. And we're going to start to reopen intakes on May 18th with some extra protections in place around sanitization, personal protective equipment and physical distancing and things of that nature. So we just try to implement the best we could CDC guidelines, the guidance that come down from HUD and other technical sources like that, and make sure that we stay there for the community who needs us.
Now, has it impacted your, you know, volunteers as far as, you know, the number of volunteers that have been working with the organization? I have to imagine you had to cut back a little bit as a result. And if so, what has the impact of that been on staff and your clientele or residents, you know, however we need to position that?
Yeah, first off, I do got to give a really huge shout out to our staff. all across the organization, we've had to deal with new procedures that we're not used to. Wearing face masks, not hugging people, not shaking hands. And I mean, with the kind of work that we do, I mean, we're a Christian ministry. Touch is really important to us. You know, interpersonal contact is extremely important to us. And so staff has done an amazing job of pivoting to doing without some of those things that are just core to who they are and still doing what we've got to do. So big shout out to them. And, you know, I would say we cut off all volunteers coming into any of our residential campuses. We shifted them all coming out to our food distribution, especially at the food bank. So what happened to the volunteers was really peaks and valleys, right? So the pandemic hit and it seemed like volunteers didn't come out at first. But then people were getting furloughed and losing their jobs. So then we had a whole bunch of volunteers. We've noticed that this week, the volunteer numbers are plummeting again. And it's because I think people are getting ready to go back to work and stuff like that. So, you know, in seasons like that, with like right now where the volunteers have gone down a lot, staff really does do a lot to pick up the slack because we depend a lot on the volunteers to deliver our services. And so, I mean, it's been up and down, man, as expected with a lot of stuff in COVID. It's just everything's so unexpected right now. So we expect the unexpected. And that's honestly what we've got with the volunteers.
I wanted to bring up one of these programs because it really excites me. And it's the Will Work program. And I know you've been instrumental in work in setting that up, and I know there's been a lot of success behind that. Go ahead, tell us a little bit about that and how it differs from other cities' programs that are similar.
Yeah, so the Will Work program is a homeless outreach program. It's a homeless outreach program that provides day labor services to individuals experiencing homelessness. We'll partner with the City of Glendale Parks Department to get referrals of locations that we can go to do beautification projects in. And then we pay the workers who work 5 hours that day, $12 an hour minimum wage. So we pay them cash, $60 at the end of the day. So the idea is that we wrap case management services around that. So as individuals are trying to get out of this situation, we've got navigators there in place to help them find housing, to help them get into recovery, behavioral health services, and things like that. And really, man, it's just been a smash. Honestly, the way it differs from a lot of other programs out there that are homeless outreach is it actually provides money and the dignity that comes along with working. Right. So once a homeless person, you know, oftentimes, and not always, because everyone's so different. So I do not want to overgeneralize. But a lot of times, man, people will just have just this sense of the way the world looks at them, a negative self view in some cases. And they seem fine. And then they go out and work. And then they start to say, man, I oftentimes have a negative self view and I feel so good. The sweat, the endorphins, and then earning pay has been a really important thing for a lot of the people that we work with. And then again, like I said, it's not a day labor service. We frame it as a homeless outreach and case management service that also provides day labor. So the real goal is to get people out of these situations. And so, yeah, it's an expandable program. We're having talks with other cities. We're even having talks with other nonprofit partners about contracting to provide this service in different places.
Wow. So a lot of, you know, they come and work for you for the day or half the day. How much of that time are you spending really communicating with them and getting to know them and building up a rapport? Because I think, like you said, that's a big part of it. It's not just, hey, go out and work 4 hours. You're off on your own. You're really, they're interacting with staff. Is that right?
Absolutely. Yeah, they come in every day. So first off, when they sign up, we go through an intake process with them. So the coordinator of the program gets to know them there, ask questions that are on the sheet, and then have a conversation with them as well. We pay them at the end of each day. So there's opportunity for conversation one-on-one there. And then throughout the day, the coordinator sees them, calls them into the van if there's things that need to be talked about, to have more conversation. And so there's just no shortage of opportunities for touch points to talk more deeply with the people that we're working. And it's just a matter of weaving them in through natural parts of the day, which is what we do pretty well. And so once we get that spark, you know, we say, all right, we can get you over to work full time with this case manager. Then if that's what you're interested in, we'll set a plan and we'll start trying to find the services that'll help you get to the goals that you're setting. And so there, like I said, plenty of opportunities throughout the day to have that conversation or throughout the course of our work with individuals to have those conversations.
You know, now one of the things you said, Nathan, that stuck out to me is that, and I find myself guilty of this, as I'm sure others do, is those preconceived notions about the homeless, and you know, when you're walking on the street and you know, just your interaction with them. I mean, so how do you combat that? I mean, how do you work with you know, with the public in you know, their approach toward the homeless, or you know, what is the education process for dopes like me who you know, may have preconceived notions, you know, to make sure that we understand that these are human beings. They're going through a difficult period. It doesn't mean that you know, that they're different from you in many ways. What does that look like?
One of the big benefits of being with the mission is that people call on you to come educate them or their group, right? They know that there's some level of lack of understanding on their part, and they want to know more, and they reach out to someone that they might be a local expert. And so this presentation I've taken on the road for several years, you know, one of the things I'll do when I go in and get an opportunity to present is I'll show two slides just to open the door, right? And I think the way I'll combat this through these presentations is by showing these slides and storytelling, right? Getting to know people in a way that you otherwise don't, because you just see the so-called bum on the street, and that picture of homelessness is not the true holistic picture. So I'll show a slide. It'll be a slide of a picture of a guy who's clearly homeless, beaten down, older, wrinkled, dirty, grungy. And I ask the group, hey, tell me what's the first word that comes to your mind? And, you know, you get dirty, tired, homeless, you know, use generally negative words. And then I'll reframe that by saying, you know, if you actually talk to this person, you'd find that they're resourceful, that they're experienced, that they are loving, and that there's all these characteristics. And it really tees up telling stories that show the other side of homelessness, the personal side of it, where these are just people like us. And then another slide that says, look at a room. What do you see in this room? There's a knife on the floor. There's three screaming children. There's a mom with a beer in her hand who's laid up, not paying attention to anything. TV's a mess. It's just crazy. And ask, when you see this picture, what do you think? And people will be like, man, oh, what do you see? I see the knife on the floor. You know, I see the screaming baby with a bottle. Is that beer in the crib? You know, things like that. And I say, you know what I see? And I hear you, because those are all problems. But I also see a home. I see a mom with the kids in the home. I see food. The pizza might not be the healthiest thing, but it is definitely something to eat. And so what I try to do, and what I think the mission as a whole tries to do, is get people to see the other side, right? To think positively and to work from that point with people, rather than what first meets you when you see them, right? What meets the eye, which is, yeah, obviously a little bit of a negative view.
Yeah. That's pretty great.
Just to think about that, you know, how quickly we are to dismiss other parts of reality, to sort of hang on to those, our preconceived notions of, you know, the negative, you know, the fear. We see him, you know, we don't see all the other stuff. So you really have to focus in and pay attention to that if you want to change the way you think about a certain group of people. I think that's really interesting. And I enjoyed that. That was great.
Yeah, it really, honestly, if there's anything I do, it's to force you to think outside of your box, right? I like to tell stories of, you know, a person's upbringing, a realistic picture of an upbringing. The first time that a person ever drank was when their mom gave them a beer at age 10. The first time they ever smoked meth was with their dad at age 12. And by the time you see them, they're a muttering bum on the streets, but you're not paying attention to the fact that their brain was wired to be developed a certain way, maybe from pre-birth. And what you're seeing now is a manifestation of a ton of trauma, a ton of problems, and also everybody's situation is different. So you might be seeing someone who just said, screw it, I'd actually rather just go live outside. Yeah. And so just really exposing people to deeper levels of thinking when it comes to how this person may have become this way, or how this person actually feels right now, because you don't know, because you haven't talked to them. I love trying to reframe people's thinking around folks they see living on the streets.
Yeah, I could definitely tell from the passion that you have and when your response to that it's certainly something that's at your core. And that's great. I would like to circle back just to the COVID situation, because, you know, we talked about education and its impact on school, and there was already a homeless issue before COVID-19, and this is only going to amplify that, I have to imagine. So I'm wondering, you know, what you're seeing already, and you know, what projections you have, and how you're, you know, we talked about how you're responding to it, but what does the future hold as it relates to homelessness? Are you expecting a spike, and how are you prepared for that?
Man, that's a really good question. First off, I would expect a spike in a lot of social problems, homelessness being among them.
Sure.
Right. So when you see unemployment rates going the way they are, naturally, you think people aren't going to be able to pay their bills. The government subsidy may eventually run out. And we're going to be stuck with a lot of people, you know, holding bills that they can't pay. And so I think that there's definitely going to be an increase in homelessness. I think, unfortunately, I would expect the trend that's been the case in Maricopa County for years now, for about 5 or 6 years now, of increasing in unsheltered homelessness, people not staying indoors at the time of the homeless count. I expect that to continue to rise. And so ways that we're looking at, right, is there's room for our workforce development programming to engage in some really important ways in this space. There are grants that are coming out where people are specifically saying, how can we expand your service to get to COVID-19 impacted folks, right? And so we're just looking at, yes, these problems are going to come. We need good workforce development programming in order to deal with it. We know that's going to be part of it for sure. And so it's just then from there expanding our reach into the places that people need us through you know, again, more collaborations for referrals and things like that.
And just connected, you know, to that is, you know, how can the public help? How can people help, you know, the Phoenix Rescue Mission in supporting those that are being impacted by COVID-19 as a result of, you know, more homelessness and other issues?
I think the big thing where the community can help us is there's certain things that we need that we're taking out to people. Right now, food donations are a huge need. We've experienced greater numbers of people coming to a lot of our services. And so making sure that we're able to have the food we need to get them fed is an important thing. Right now, I would say one of the biggest pain points we have is that staff is working really hard to make sure that the food bank provides the critical services to our community that we need. And people are not volunteering as much as they once were. So having people come down to 5605 North 55th Avenue, downtown Glendale, Hope for Hunger Food Bank, and provide us their valuable time sometime between the hours of 8 and noon is my number one biggest ask. We need to make sure we have the bandwidth, we have the bodies that it takes to get food into these families' homes.
Excellent. You know, hopefully folks listening to this will take advantage of that. And so where can folks go for more information? You know, obviously they can visit on site, but you know, what's your website address, Nathan?
Yep, www.phoenixrescuemission.org. A really easy website to navigate, and you can find out a whole lot more about us there, including how you can help.
Excellent. And just one final question. I really want to kind of tie this back to, I have to, you know, you were inspired by your trip to India. I wonder, you know, have you put, you know, pressure on someone else to go on another trip with you or on their own, and have seen, you know, the impact that has had on them, you know, kind of paying it forward, if you will, as you know, your church leader did with you. Just wondering if you've done the same to others.
Oh yeah. Oh man, I got married in India to an American woman. She was out there with me for a while. One of my really good friends took him out there, and he had the same kind of experience I did. He married an Indian woman, brought her back to the States. They have a family now. It's amazing. He's bought property out there. He's building farms. He's reinvesting his money in India to help them build infrastructure. And so And there's been countless people who've gone on these trips with me, and some I've dragged by with a headlock, kicking and screaming. Others are excited to come. But one constant, I don't know a person who's gone and hasn't had their life changed at some level and has been vocal about it. I just don't. I mean, and we've gone out there with dozens of people. I've dragged people. I have had three kids since I first started going. And so, I don't get to go spend the summers there like I used to. It's been a little while at this point. That's why I work so much locally now. But man, somebody's going to drag me back one day too, for sure.
Yeah, sign me up, man. I would love to go on a trip like that, you know. It sounds amazing. So we'll touch base offline.
Yeah, let's do it.
So have you taken your kids, Nathan? And if not, you know, what's the age that you bring them on either to India or another mission trip?
Yeah, I haven't yet. Next year we're going to go down to Mexico and build a house, and that'll be, you know, they're again 9 and 7 now, so they'll be actually 9 and 7 then. By the time I want to go. And so we'll go down, and there's some home building ministries in Mexico that we can partner with. They're shorter, you know, a weekend or a little longer than that. So we can kind of dabble there a couple times and then see how that works. You can do missions trips to the Native American reservations, and there's a lot of ministries that you can partner with there. So we're starting doing that stuff next year. Part of my big setback, though, man, is I had another baby. I want to meet another kid. And so I have a 1-year-old and set me back in doing this stuff for a while. But yeah, the bigger ones, though, they'll be going down next year and doing something internationally.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, thank you, Nathan, so much for your time. I appreciate it. And, best of luck with your mission at Phoenix Rescue Mission and the work that you folks are doing. Would certainly encourage folks, to visit the website, get more information, figure out how they can support the organization and the great work you folks are doing. So thank you again for coming on the Purposeful Pitch.
Yeah, Joe, hey, I really appreciate you having me, giving me an opportunity to share about the work that the mission is doing, the work that I really believe a lot in, man. And so anytime I can have a chance to tell about that, I'm happy to be here. So thanks. It's been a real blessing.
Excellent. Thank you so much, sir.
Yeah. See you guys.
Take it easy.